In the year 2010, King Abdullah II of Jordan came to the UN General Assembly, the 65th meeting of that assembly, and proposed an idea for World Interfaith Harmony Week to further broaden his goals of a faith-driven world harmony by extending a call beyond Muslim and Christian community where he had been working on dialogue to include people of all beliefs, those with no set religious beliefs as well. A few weeks later, Prince Ghazi bin Muhammad presented the proposal to the UN General Assembly, where it was adopted unanimously as a UN observance event, and World Interfaith Harmony Week began in this first week of February. Like all the previous endeavors of King Abdullah, it's not a call to water down anyone's faith, but rather it's a call to respect our differences and our personal beliefs and to unite around the basic principles that people of all beliefs agree upon, and to understand harmony can only come if we build upon a solid foundation of dialogue of good and love of the neighbor are the core principle for engagement. More than ever before, our world is confronting multiple global crises which cannot be effectively addressed without a coordinated multilateral action. No country can face these crises and provide for its future in isolation. The threats are global, and so are the solutions. A strong central role for the United Nations is essential. It's also essential to resist forces of division that spread misunderstanding and mistrust, especially among people of different religions. The fact is, humanity everywhere is bound together, not only by mutual interests, but by shared commandments to love God and neighbor, to love the good and neighbor. This week, my delegation, with the support of our friends on every continent, will introduce a draft resolution for an annual World Interfaith Harmony Week. What we are proposing is a special week during which the world's peoples in their own place of worship could express the teachings of their own faith about intolerance, respect for the other, and peace. I hope this resolution has your support. Thanks to King Abdullah, we have this time of year, of course, in South Carolina, we just celebrated the interfaith work in this community and began in February sharing that celebration in the world of interfaith harmony, recognizing that we have way more in common than we have different, even across our religious lines. Now, I consider this that just everybody else in the world is catching up with us. Right, we had this figured out a while ago, so it's good that King Abdullah has finally figured out that we had something working here. And of course, in the 1960s, Unitarianism and Universalism joined together, believing that their voices together could be way more powerful in a world if they were in harmony with each other. Universalism has really existed for a long time and can be tracked to even the third century of understanding that all souls are good, all souls are united in a hope and a growth and a progression toward love. So it is a celebration of faith and religion and finding the things in common that we have instead of focusing on those differences. Mark Twain said that God created man in his own image, and man, being a gentleman, returned the favor. And I truly believe there's a lot of truth to what Twain has said, and I thought about reading some of his private notes about God, but then I also like being here as your minister and not being kicked out. And I love that as the UN adopted this principle, it did not focus on religion and spirituality as just an expression of how you relate to God, but actually a celebration of how you relate to good as well, if a deity or a God is not something that is a part of your spirituality. Joseph Campbell says, as we quoted him earlier, he says about God that God is a metaphor for that which transcends all levels of intellectual thought. And then, as he is often known for, he finishes that powerful phrase by saying, it's as simple as that. And maybe it is just as simple as that. If we pause and just think for a moment that God might be a metaphor. So we're not going to take some time this morning and figure out whether or not there is an actual God. But what we are going to do is recognize that how we understand whatever it is that we name as God or good, as something greater than ourselves, is indeed a metaphor. Even the most conservative of faiths recognize that the mystery of that deity cannot be explained in words, and therefore we do our best with metaphors, with words, with language, with story, in an attempt to understand and explain what cannot be explained. I was sitting in a class one time, in philosophy class, and my Buddhist professor had invited a Buddhist teacher from California to come and share with us about the Buddhist faith, and she said, as she got up in front of us, that her job there is to teach about nirvana, the nirvana experience. And as a college student, we were very excited with what happened next, for she said, class is over. Go home. We were like, yes. We all became fans. We all became Buddhists that day as well. But her point was, how can I explain an experience that once you begin to explain it, you move away from it? If I try to put it in words, if I try to describe it to you, all of a sudden you are no longer in that experience. And so we left and experienced it. We often argue about these metaphors, and that's exactly what we do when we get religions together that are at odds with each other. We're not arguing about things about our humanity. We're arguing about the metaphors and how you understand the metaphors that explain our spirituality. We argue about, is it God, is it not a God? We argue about, is it one God or is it multiple gods? We argue about the name of that God or the image of that God. And all of it is just arguments of metaphors. Simply taking the symbols and the images that we have, which is the best that we have, and trying to understand and connect. One of the things I love about Hinduism is Hinduism sees a god, and if they like it, they just say, well, we'll take that one too. We like that one. We'll absorb it into our many, many images and faces of deities. And even in the Christian tradition, even ancient stories recorded in Scripture show an Apostle Paul, an educated man, who walks into a Greek cathedral area of worship and says, I see that you are religious people. I see the images and the faces of all of these deities here. So we could argue about all these metaphors and all these symbols and do our best to try to connect, okay, well, this symbol matches that, or this kind of connection matches that. And oftentimes people will take different religions and try to merge them together, try to merge the metaphors together. And that's beautiful work when it happens, and we see that as the golden thread has been connecting in all of our faith traditions around the world and religions. But really, there's a better way to connect, because behind every metaphor that is created is a human emotion or a human need that then creates that metaphor. Some of the most popular images of deities are parental figures. Well, there are human emotions and human needs that long for a parent in our lives. It's one of the most basic that we have. And therefore, we place on the face of the deities the image of parent, the image of father, mother, the image of someone who is caring for us. We also have images of kings, which we don't really recognize anymore, although we may be heading back in that direction. When Marcus Borg wrote his book, The God We Never Knew, he said, in the U.S., we have no concept of what it lives like under a king. If Marcus Borg were alive today, I wonder what he would say about that. Images of king, leader, warrior, protector are always those images that we post on the faces of the deity. And it's not that they are connecting to other religions or other faith traditions. They often borrow those symbols. But the important thing is they're speaking to the need inside of us that wants someone to protect us, someone to lead us, someone to comfort us when we are hurting. When I was growing up in a Baptist Christian church, one of the songs we sang often was The Lily of the Valley. And it's a beautiful image in Hebrew scripture, the lily of the valley. And I have to admit that I was an adult before I even figured out what that was. I just sang it all the time. He's the lily of the valley, not knowing what that meant. But lily of the valley, and looking at it, the image of a valley, an experience where the sun is hiding, where oftentimes darkness and trouble comes along our way, there is a bright spot, an image of a beautiful flower in the midst of that experience. And one of the things I realized as I started researching lilies and flowers is so many religions, through the image of lotus flower and others, have the experience of this lily, this flower that grows out of darkness and nothingness. So what does that mean, that everybody's looking at the same flower? Maybe. I think it means that everybody knows what it's like to live in a valley, to have an experience where we cannot find our way, we feel lost, and in that experience to long for some bright light to guide us and bring us hope in the midst of all of that pain. That is the human experience. A valley is something we all know, whether you're living in this country or any country around the world. Valleys are common experiences. When Martin Heidegger developed his understanding of the person by the quadrants of the body, the soul, the spirit, the body, the emotional self, and the social self, because he could not wrap his mind around how understanding Christianity can somehow connect to this beautiful quadrant of understanding human beings, he just left religion off. He's like, I'm just going to avoid spirituality in its entirety when I look at mapping out human beings. But a long time later, a beautiful therapist named Emmy Van Deerzen in England took his work and said, you know what? Spirituality transcends just one faith experience, whether it's a good faith experience or whether it's a not-so-great faith experience. And Martin Heidegger did not want to recognize that there was religions in the world, but also there are those who did not believe in any kind of deity, any kind of transcendent being. And Emmy Van Deerzen says, everyone has something higher than themselves that they connect to. It may not have a face, it may not have a name, it may not be a deity at all, but there is something that calls them to a greater sense of self. And then that desire for a greater sense of self, something bigger than us, we move to metaphor. How else could we explain it? How else could we understand this thing, this experience, bigger than you and me, whether we have it named as God or whether we have it named as good, whether we name it as love, whether we name it as nature. It carries the face of metaphor and the only ability that we have to understand it. In the movie Contact, which came out a long time ago as I was preparing this sermon and realizing and looking at the dates of movies, it's like, this feels like it came out when I was just a little while ago, and then I realized a long time ago. I'm not saying I feel old, but that's what I'm saying. But in the movie Contact, and I feel at this point, because it was so long ago, that if I give away the ending, you will forgive me. But the beings that bring Dr. Ellie Arroway into a relationship and a meeting with them, and this character is played by Jodie Foster, when they finally bring her, however they bring her through the wormhole to the place where they meet and talk, they use images of her dad, who talks to her, and they use images of Pensacola, Florida, that she grew up in and loved. And what the movie is really tapping into is that's how we understand things that are mystery. That's the only way we can understand them, is to somehow connect it to something familiar in our experience. That is how God was birthed into our experience as human beings, by way of understanding things beyond ourselves and using metaphors to do it. So I guess the question is, if the metaphor is different and unique for all of us, but the human experience is the same, what would it be for you and me? What would be familiar for us in Columbia, South Carolina, if those beings brought us to another place, if we were in the movie Contact and created something familiar? What would it be around Columbia that they used to make us feel safe and at home? Would it be the Adula Gritz building up the road? It's like, oh, now I know I'm in Columbia. My thought is it would just be brought to a sauna and go, well, this feels like home, and this I recognize. 100 degrees and 100% humidity, thank you for making me feel right at home. What would be a familiar face of love in your history that you would talk to, that would make you feel comforted and connected to something greater than yourself? The metaphors are different and unique across cultures and religions, but the human need and emotion that we feel is what can connect us to every single human being and transcend every geographical and every cultural divide. It is what we do here in this place. It's what creates community and commonality in our congregation. As our guys were so beautifully singing, the saints go marching in, and added some verses which highlight our UU faith. It's what creates community here, to recognize that we are not tied or judge anybody's metaphor for how they understand something greater than themselves. But what connects us is our search for truth and meaning and our humanity and those emotions and needs in us that beckon us to look up and try to find it. May we continue to celebrate the beautiful metaphors.